an analytical sociologist, I'm afraid I'm smack dab in the middle of Mr. Devine's forest, and my blade isn't very sharp. I don't know where the outer limits of the circle are. I'm not even sure what trees are worth cutting or not worth cutting. I'm locked in there, and I'm not even sure I can get out or whether I want to get out, but I have some problems that perhaps might help me get out. I want to share them with you. Some of them are theoretical, some are practical. They derive primarily from the exchange of views which was had yesterday between Irving Kristol and Milton Friedman and Ernest Vandenhagen. The place to begin, it seems to me, in discussing the topic of this particular panel, the future of conservatism in a post-liberal age, the place to begin, it seems to me, is with two questions. One is, will there be anything worth conserving in a post-liberal age? And secondly, if there is, can we conserve it? I put it to you that that is a dilemma. At least it's a dilemma for me. I believe it was a dilemma for Irving Kristol. I believe he stated a genuine dilemma, the genuineness of which was, I think, in effect, denied by Professor Friedman. Nonetheless, I am going to come out on the side of Professor Kristol. The dilemma that he posed in fine was this, that in seeking to conserve those things which libertarian or traditionalist conservatives now seek to conserve, we may be conserving something which contains the seed of its own destruction. It's a possibility. I think that's a genuine problem. I think it's worthy of discussion. We may come out differently than Mr. Kristol. We may decide it's not a genuine problem. Suffice it to say for me, I think it is. Now, the full character of that dilemma, I think, is disguised, has been disguised on a theoretical level, at least. I think, however, it's rather poignantly demonstrated on a practical level. And it is most poignantly revealed in what I call technocracy, the more or less imminent threat of what I call the men in the white coats in the laboratory. Mr. Kristol referred to the threat of the atom bomb in the basement. That, frankly, is of less concern to me than the ultimate implications of those things which are now going on in biological laboratories at the hands of biologists, biochemists, geneticists, and so on. The nature of much of this new technocracy is such that it will not be possible to opt out of its effects. It is well and good for Professor Friedman, whom I esteem greatly, to say that one may have the choice to watch the late movie or not watch the late movie or watch the news or not watch the news or to buy this or not buy that. The difficulty with much of modern technology, and I think increasingly so, will be that a variety of goods and ideas associated with them, techniques, devices, and so on, will soon become more or less readily available, and if the efficacy of the market continues to be what it has been in the past, they will become available relatively cheaply and can be distributed over a rather large segment of the literate population. Their effects, however, will be such, as I say, that for all intents and purposes, one cannot choose to opt out of them. One concrete example that comes immediately to mind arising out of the SST controversy concerns the stratosphere. If in point of fact, the idea of governmental subsidy aside for the moment, if in point of fact the SST proves to be environmentally dangerous, that's the ball game. You cannot opt out of it. Once the stratosphere is adversely affected, it adversely affects the whole world in a more or less permanent way that could well be insoluble. That kind of problem, it seems to me, is a genuine problem. It is one to which conservatism must sooner or late address itself. It's one which will continually arise, I think, in an increasing number of ways. Now, this dilemma, it seems to me, is a contemporary reformulation, reappearance of what is a rather old problem. It's as old as Socrates. It is the problem of the claims of science or philosophy on the one hand versus the claims of politics on the other. Now this dilemma is, as I say, an old one. It is obscured from us, I think, in modern times by virtue of the fact that modern politics rests on a base which attempts to found all regimes, all politics, on an objective, on the basis of an objective philosophical order. Now, ancient political philosophy, and a good deal of medieval political philosophy as well, denied that possibility, and as such understood that the claims of politics and the claims of science or philosophy, on the other hand, were mutually antinomous. In the ancient world, that antinomy achieves its most dramatic conflict in the trial and death of Socrates. Something not unlike that, it seems to me, was revealed in the exchange between Professor Vandenhagen and Professor Friedman in reaction to Mr. Crystal's posing of the dilemma. Now, it was interesting that Mr. Friedman came down on the side of science, in effect, underlying which, it seems to me, was an essentially beneficent view of the effects of technology. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Which, it seems to me, given the more or less imminent threat we face from technocracy, is something of a chapter-critical statement. Professor Friedman came down on the side of science, but I do not know, because of the inability to opt out of the effects that this science and technology will produce, I do not know that we can be indifferent to the widespread dissemination of ideas and products which threaten the very foundations of political life altogether. One may not be able to opt out. On the other hand, I thought it interesting that Professor Vandenhagen came down fully on the side of society and reduced what began, it seemed to me, as a sound, commonsensical, prudential judgment and extended it into an absurd proposition, to wit, that if he were a member of a headhunting society, he would be a headhunter. How that particular assertion differs from the proposition that if one were, for example, in Germany in the 1930s, he would be a Nazi, I don't know. I don't mean to implicate the good Professor Vandenhagen on that point. It seems to me that the principle involved is essentially indistinguishable. But both men have a point. Both men have a point. To Professor Friedman, the claims of science are supreme. The defect with his position, it seems to me, is the assumption that they will, for all intents and purposes, permanently be compatible with the claims of political life. Professor Vandenhagen, on the other hand, would elevate conventional wisdom, however barbaric it may be, and deny legitimacy to the claims of philosophy or science. And the error there, it seems to me, is to grant to vulgar political life, commonly understood, a kind of claim which is removing from politics the possibility of criticizing it from the perspective of essentially philosophical understanding of the nature of things, simply. Now, it seems to me that a conservatism which is indifferent to the byproducts of the new technocracy, which is to say a conservatism which is essentially indifferent to the impact of a variety of eugenic devices on the social order, is a conservatism hardly worthy of the name. If for no other reason than that, that will be a conservatism with nothing left to conserve. Or let us put it this way, it will be a conservatism which doesn't know, or will find it very difficult to know what it wishes to conserve. Now, so much for what I think is a genuine theoretical problem. On a more practical level, the implications of that dilemma, I think, are these. It seems to me that in this post-liberal age, and whether we are in it or about to go in it or are just out of it, I'm not altogether sure. I'm still in Mr. Devine's forest on that. But on a practical level, it seems to me that there is one fundamentally important question facing conservatism, which has two subparts to it. The one single all-embracing question we must begin to talk about, and in rather serious ways, is essentially the question of popular opinion. Who shall teach what to whom? Who shall be, in the final analysis, the molders of public opinion? The two subparts of this to which I think conservatism must address itself in the concrete is, in particular, who shall teach what to the young, writing off, for all intents and purposes, an older generation? And secondly, what shall be done with regard to the imminent byproducts of technocracy? Both of these questions may involve, and I simply want to put them out to you for thoughtful consideration, the resolution of these questions on a practical level may involve the necessity of limitations of freedom, commonly understood, against which traditional conservative theory rails. I don't know. I put it to you as a possibility. It's something worth thinking about. Perhaps I'm stating a false dilemma. It seems to me that it's a genuine one. Now, it seems to me that the problem on a practical level is particularly poignant in this regime, which is, after all, a representative democracy. A representative democracy is a regime which answers the fundamental political question, who shall rule? With the answer, every man. On a more or less equal basis. Particularly in such a regime, those who are, as we purport to be, the conservators of civilization, cannot be indifferent to the nature and quality of ideas entertained by every man. And it may be under the imminent threat of technocracy, and in the decline and fall of almost anything vaguely resembling true liberal education in this country, we're going to have to think in very concrete terms about who shall be teaching what to who. I put it to you in respect of Mr. Vandenhagen's remark that where he were to find himself in a headhunting society, he'd prefer to be a headhunter. I put it to you, we may very soon find ourselves in just such a society, and we may have to decide for ourselves and as well for others whether we want to be headhunters or whether indeed it is open to us to be something else. And those, I think, are some interesting questions. Perhaps they are not the right questions, but I think they're some good food for thought. Thank you.